Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work. Enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikitas.
Hello, and thanks for joining us here for episode 380 with Jane Ransom. Jane is talking about different pathways to personal change. So you'll learn one, scientific proof for the effectiveness of hypnosis. Two, how to strengthen neural pathways to achieve behavioral change. And three, the interconnectedness of self-discipline with self-forgiveness. So if you want to take a look at the show notes or the transcript or the links to items we've referenced, you'll find it over at awesomeatyourjob.com/F380. While visiting awesomeatyourjob.com, I hope you check out some of our cool stuff. One cool thing is the Gold Nugget email list, which gives you summary wisdom from Jane and access to all 380 guests, little bite-sized tidbits you can read in 2 to 5 minutes to get some of the core wisdom all the more quickly. We take those notes for you. Call the Gold Nuggets over at awesomeatyourjob.com. Now here's Jane's story. Jane Ransom is a coach, speaker, trainer, master hypnotist, dedicated optimist, and an incurable science nerd. The international publisher Quarto Group recently released her book, Self-Intelligence, the new science-based approach to reaching your true potential. Jane helps individuals transform their lives and works with organizations to improve leadership and strengthen employee engagement. Here is Jane. Jane, thanks so much for joining us here on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
I am truly excited to be here.
Oh, me too. Me too. But first, I want to hear a little bit about your story in terms of you have an interesting relationship with practical jokes, you mentioned. Can you unpack this both on the giving and receiving side?
Yeah. And by the way, so I answered that. That was, you know, in answer to your question, like what's something that people don't know about you? And the reason they don't know about that is because I never talk about it. So after I sent that to you, I thought, what have I done? But now that it's out there, I'll run with it. So I'm just really gullible. I choose to trust people, and I would rather be trusting, you know, than cynical. But that means that I'm very open to practical jokes. So I can give you an example of a certain kind that's not even that inventive, but I have fallen for it more than once. So Pete, let's say we have lunch together. Mm-hmm. And here's how you can fool me, because it'll still work even after I've told you. That's the sad part. Okay, so let's say I've got a veggie burger and some beautiful, sweet potato fries. And we're talking. And you point over my shoulder and you say, oh my gosh, doesn't that look like Meryl Streep? And so I turn around and it doesn't at all look like Meryl Streep. But because I don't want to embarrass you because I'm really nice, I'll like try to make it work. So I'll look really hard and like think, okay, well, maybe. And I'll turn back around and I'll say, well, I don't know, but you know, maybe. And we'll keep talking. And then after a little bit, I'll notice that my fries have moved to your plate.
Oh.
Right. And that will totally crack me up.
No. So people have done this to you multiple times.
Yes.
I've never thought to steal fries, nor have I had my fries stolen, but now I'm inspired.
It could be anything. It doesn't have to be fries, you know, but.
Now, that's a good trick for being awesome at your job is free food.
And I could tell you a joke. So I am fooled more than I do in reverse. But once I did, way back in the day, before internet travel reservations and so on, I knew I was going to be sitting beside my oldest brother on a plane trip. And this is actually when you had to make a phone call to make a plane reservation. Mm-hmm. And I was able to say, well, where is Farley Ransom sitting? Can you put me by him, but don't tell him? And they actually said, okay. So, anyway, I had long hair then, and I had just had a perm. I had big hair, and I wore sunglasses, and I wore this crazy outfit, and I put on these like stick-on nails, so I looked really goofy. And I sat down by my brother, and I left my sunglasses on, and I kept trying to talk, make conversation. I was like, "Hi, where are you from?" You know, and I was so ditzy. He tried not to talk with me, so. In order to force him to talk with me, I had to spill my water on him, you know, just kind of knock it over on him. And then he had to talk to me just to be nice, because of course I would have felt so embarrassed. And then we had this conversation and I was like, where are you going? And I'm going to Indiana. Oh, I grew up in Indiana, and it went on like that until finally I said, I think I know you. And I pulled the sunglasses off and I said, I really think I know you. Don't you know me? And the poor guy, he stared at me. He's, oh, no, no. And then there was this shock. And then he just looked completely horrified.
Wow. That is sophisticated.
I don't know if he ever recovered.
I'm going to tuck that away. That's good. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I was trying to think of, well, how could this be meaningful at all after I sent that info off to you? And I thought, what I think it's about for me and why I like to be fooled is that it really helps me to laugh at myself, because I feel like one of the ways we hold ourselves back is we get so serious, we feel so bad about mistakes. We have to be right. We get very uptight. And there's no better way to shake yourself loose than to, feel really silly for a moment.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Very nice. Well, so let's talk about your book, Self-Intelligence. Sounds like an important thing. What's your main thesis here?
Okay. The main thesis, I think, is there are many roads to Rome, but there are also a set of proven roads to Rome, Rome being positive change. And if we could pause for a moment, or just to lay a little bit of groundwork here, the book partly sprang out of, my own enthusiasm over the discovery of brain plasticity. And Pete, the reason I would like to pause on that is because I go around talking about brain plasticity and people nod their heads, but not everybody actually understands what it is. So could I take a moment just to kind of describe?
Oh, sure. Go for it.
Okay. So, when I was grown up, what I was told was that the brain stops changing and developing after a certain age, basically when you're a kid, but certainly by your 20s, because that's when the prefrontal cortex, kind of sets in. And so what that meant was, your brain is set. Once you're an adult, your personality is set, your intelligence is set, your character traits, whether you're a procrastinator or not, whether you're self-disciplined or not, whether you're a cheerful person or not, all that's set, you're done. And what happened was around the 1980s, this brain imaging technology started coming in, driven by computers. Once scientists were able to look inside the brain, what they found was that brain plasticity is real. Until then, just a few outliers had been arguing for it, but no one believed in it. And what that means, plasticity as in plastic, as in malleable, we each have about 100 billion neurons, or our thinking brain cells. And they each have at least, say, 1,000 connection each. So we've got at least 100 trillion connections among our neurons. Well, plasticity means those are constantly shifting and remapping. And so you've got all these connections and brain maps, and they're constantly shifting and remapping. What that means is that we can literally reform our brains by choosing better thoughts, better experiences, and better actions. And why scientists didn't believe that for so long, until they could see it due to the neuroimaging technology, why they didn't believe it is because people don't seem to change. Mm-hmm. And they don't seem to change because very often it's quite natural to maintain homeostasis. We go around thinking and doing the same old things. And so if we do that, we're just continually remapping our brains onto the same old, same old. If you decide to change, it's not that hard. The brain is actually set up for your entire life to be changeable. So this is a revolution in neuroscience. And by now people have heard the term, but to really take that good news in, I think it's astounding.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And it's inspiring, in terms of the potential and what that can mean for someone in their life and their potential for where they can go. It's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened was in 2008, my dad had died. He'd had lung cancer. He'd been a smoker. And then, and I, I had read this book about brain plasticity I was really excited about. And then my dad died. And before that, my stepfather and my mother had died of lung cancer, been smokers. And my father had never been able to quit smoking. And somehow I stumbled upon the information that hypnosis was an effective way to quit smoking. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting. And then I started kind of a deep dive into the science, like, is hypnosis real? And wow, yeah, there's lots of science on it. And I also was open because I'd just been reading about brain plasticity. So it made sense to me. Okay, hypnosis is a way into the brain to kind of speed up, you know, to put on hyperspeed brain plasticity. I got my training and I opened an office. I was living in San Francisco, opened an office in downtown San Francisco, and started a hypnosis practice, helping people, among many other things, to quit smoking. But what happened was people would come in and they would be so excited about their results that then they would ask me for help with other stuff, you know, like help me with my relationship or help me get a promotion. And hypnosis isn't a magic bullet for everything. Being a science nerd, I would run home and read all, you know, keep reading the science. And so I would be helping my clients by gathering all these science-based tools. And there's so much. Once brain plasticity was discovered, that's launched many new fields of investigation, because once scientists realized, oh my gosh, we can change, people can change. Now many, many scientists are, you know, investigating, well, how do we change? What actually works? And as I was gathering those tools, I was kind of spewing them at my clients in my nerdy way. And one of them said, can't you just like put this into kind of a pretty picture for me? And so I started forming this model of self-intelligence that's basically got sort of five routes into personal change. And then I started sharing that. And one of my clients said, well, why don't you put it in a book? I was like, okay. And then followed about 6 years of deep dive research and testing and practicing.
Mm-hmm. And so let's hear a little bit. These five routes, what are they?
Okay, so one is programming the subconscious self. When I was growing up, that, you know, hypnosis was like, ooh, you know, considered kind of spooky. And the word subconscious was sort of the same, you know, ooh. But now with brain imaging technology, we know that most of our brain activity is subconscious. If you want to change yourself and your habits, you've got to deal with the subconscious. And there are ways of more or less directly dealing with it. For example, programming your dreams, or hypnosis, it's another one, visualization, things like that. So that's one portal. Another one is conditioning your conscious self, you know, self-talk, a gratitude practice. I don't actually talk about that in the book because so many people already know about it. But being aware of choices, becoming more aware of that everything you're doing is a choice, being aware of your self story, things like that. So there's conditioning your conscious self. And then, and you've talked about this on your show, three is thinking through your embodied self, the mind-body loop. You really can't take apart the mind and the body anymore. And knowing that what we do with our bodies can directly influence our thoughts and emotions. So that's embodied cognition. I love that stuff. I think you've talked about, have you had Amy Cuddy on your show? I think someone's talked about it on your show.
You know, not yet. I think the day is coming, but she has definitely come up.
Yeah, yeah. So her work, and you know, it's not just her. There are, you know, scores of other scientists doing amazing research there. So that's the body, brain loop, the embodied self. And then four is integrating your social self. When I was growing up, friendship was not considered important to one's mental health or physical health. Now we know otherwise. Not only is social connection vital to your well-being, but it's also vital to professional success. So that's been a wonderful new area of research as well. So that's integrating your social self. And then the fifth one is vitalizing your striving self, where I zero in more directly on, okay, goals, setting goals, achieving goals, how we can best do that, and how we do that in order to pursue meaning in our lives. I think that we are all naturally strivers. And when we stop striving, I think that's not a good idea. So that's the fifth one, vitalizing your striving self.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm perhaps most intrigued by the subconscious piece because we haven't talked about it a whole lot on the show. And secondly, you know, you have lots of hypnosis experience. And thirdly, you're all about the science. So I can just candidly ask, you know, the hard questions about the evidence base associated with them. So let's talk about the programming of the subconscious self. And so can you maybe first orient us to what extent is that possible, or what are the limitations? Like, what's too much to expect from what you can get from programming the subconscious self versus what's something that is totally achievable if we're looking to take her around in there?
Okay. I wouldn't put any limits on what's achievable, but I would say that this has to do with brain plasticity. So when we're talking about programming the subconscious self, or when we're talking about any kind of change, but think about this in terms of brain plasticity, what we're doing is we're going in and we're laying down new neural pathways, right? Now, to make those pathways stick takes practice, a habit, repetition. Mm-hmm. So, for example, somebody might come in for a hypnosis session and they often people want to just feel better and they might leave feeling great. But now to continue feeling great, they're going to have to keep reinforcing those new neural pathways. It can vary from client to client too, because some clients are high hypnotizables. I should also tell you, and I'm happy to talk about hypnosis. I love it and I use it all the time on myself. I'm a self-hypnosis junkie. But I should also tell you, it's just like one tool in my toolbox now. But the science is very real. And I'm so thrilled. On the back of my book, one of the blurbs is by Elvira Lang, who used to teach at Harvard Medical School. And she is probably the world's top researcher on the uses of hypnosis for medical procedures. So she's done studies involving many, many hundreds of people. She's found at Harvard, these were done, that people, you know, they need less anesthetic when they've prepared using hypnosis. They suffer fewer infections. The surgery takes less time because the body is subconsciously cooperating with the surgery. The patient later heals faster. And here's what's extraordinary. Even bones heal faster if the patient has prepared for the surgery using hypnosis. Isn't that astonishing?
Well, I love that because in the world of clinical medical stuff, it's all about the numbers and there's no fudging outside of outright fraud or abusive reporting of things. But anyway, so that's pretty cool setting in terms of its high scrutiny and high evidence basis there. So that's intriguing. So, okay, I find if that's the case, then it's easy to believe that, you know, hypnosis may have some good impact on you, say, feeling more confident and less anxious and being more, you know, creative and having more great ideas. So let's talk about it. If we've established that hypnosis can work, what does one do to lay some of that neural pathway and do some of this hypnosis work to impact the subconscious?
Yeah. Great question. So hypnosis can be used for so many different things because the mind can be used for so many different things, right? But I mentioned self-hypnosis, and I use self-hypnosis, for example. I was a lifelong insomniac, and I think this may run in my family somewhat. But so whether it's genetic, epigenetic, whatever, I use self-hypnosis every night to get to sleep. And when I wake up, I use it to get right back to sleep. And what I like about it is that it actually involves a certain amount of self-discipline so that, I have to focus, which is counterintuitive, right? You would think that going to sleep is just like, oh, you know, let it go and relax. Well, sometimes relaxing actually takes discipline. And so that's one thing I use self-hypnosis for. But you're absolutely right. You can use it to dial up confidence. I have a little free self-hypnosis mini course on my website that people can, you know, go and learn it there if they want to. I can share with you a funny thing. Would you like a funny example of how do you use hypnosis at work?
Funny is good. But I guess what I most want to know is what are the practices, sort of the how-to with regard to most reliably getting some positive results?
Well, so it's quite easy basically to hypnotize people. Maybe a little background here. there are high hypnotizables and low hypnotizables. And we're not really sure why. We're not sure whether it's brain structure. It seems to have something to do with whether someone is easily absorbed, like the kind of person who can like just, you know, drop down into a novel and forget everything else. But we're not really sure why. I also want to just come clean and say we don't really know what hypnosis is. And somebody that pretends to know what it is not actually well informed. But keep in mind, we don't really know what gravity is either. But they both work. Okay. And there's major, you know, research that show that they both work. In terms of the how-to, there are many ways to hypnotize people. I work with people sometimes just over the phone, so I can use language to hypnotize people. There's the old visual use of, you know, remember the swinging watch?
All right.
Mm-hmm. And that's a Hollywood stereotype, but it could actually work. Sometimes, you know, we use visual fixation. Milton Erickson, who was a psychiatrist, who was probably one of the most famous hypnotists ever, was said to be able to hypnotize someone by shaking their hand in a certain way that confused them, led them in one direction and then in another direction mentally, and then they would just sort of give up and drop in without knowing it. So in terms of the how-to, there are various techniques. This course I have on my site throws a bunch of them in there, but there are many, many ways to bring a person into hypnosis. Now, about maybe 10% of the population are what we call high hypnotizables. Some people call them somnambulists. Those people go right in. I mean, they are so easy to hypnotize. And I feel jealous of them because they also often have that sort of like they're being in a movie experience. I had one client that used to, you know, she'd come in and say, oh, well, we're doing the other stuff. Can I go flying around through the pink stuff again today?
Oh.
I'd be like, yeah, okay. Now, when I'm hypnotized, whether it's self-hypnosis or by somebody else, I don't go flying around in the pink stuff. Like for me, it's the conscious experience of it is more or less like just being deeply relaxed. But it still works for me. Often the result is a little bit more delayed. With my own self-hypnosis for sleep, obviously it's not so delayed, but I'm a low hypnotizable. Some of the non-medical research has been on high hypnotizables just because scientists know that they are going in. So one of those studies, it's used PET scan, and I think it's been done with fMRIs as well, where they give people a piece of paper with black and white designs on it, and they put them in the brain imaging, you know, machine, and they say, okay, imagine that those black and white images are in color. You're seeing colors. And they measure the brain activity and look at what the brain's doing.
So are your eyes open while you're looking at the black and white images, or are they closed?
I think they'd be open.
Okay.
But I'm not sure whether the people are allowed to close their eyes when they're asked to imagine. But then they put them in hypnosis, right? So first they take these people and they see what's going on when they just imagine it. Then they hypnotize them. And again, for the experiment, they're using high hypnotizables because those people just go in so fast. And then they give them the same instructions. Now, not only do those people report seeing vivid colors, but their visual cortex is just going wild. They are seeing those colors. There's no doubt.
Intriguing.
Yeah, yeah. But so those are the high hypnotizables. So the strategies to go into hypnosis are wide and varied.
Well, why don't we maybe just grab your favorite? Let's say it's just me, Pete Mikaitis, or the listener.
Okay.
And let's say we're looking to have more confidence and ability to speak up at work and less sort of anxiety and self-consciousness. What would you say, given all you know, might be your best bet approach for self-hypnosis to get some progress here?
Well, so first, it's going to take practice. So this is the thing. I'd learn if you wanted to do that. And I'm not plugging myself here to plug myself, but like go do the mini course because it really is a mini course. It won't take you long at all. But the thing is to practice. So first get good. I mean, if you're high hypnotizable, hey, you're way ahead of the game, but most of us aren't. So the first thing is to learn how to go into hypnosis, to kind of get used to that. The more you practice it, the faster you can drop into a trance, right? And then once you drop, so then I would say the way I prepare people is I have them practice doing a couple things. I have them first practice mental imaging. Like if I'm teaching someone, and I like to teach all my clients self-hypnosis because I want to send them out, you know, I don't want my clients hanging around forever. I want them to go mm-hmm. on their own. So I teach them, some of them, I improve their mental imaging skills. And you could do that, and you can use this for other kinds of visualization too. Say, because I meet people sometimes, well, I don't know how to visualize. Well, yeah, you do. There's a couple ways to do that. But one easy way is just to look up, see everything in front of you, close your eyes, try to reconstruct what you just saw, look up, see what you left out.
Okay.
Keep doing that exercise, right? The other one, another way to increase your visual imaging strength is to close your eyes. And I love this one. Like imagine some food on a plate. I often do a red apple on a white plate, but you can make it anything. And imagine that you like that food, right? So pick something you like if you don't like apples and make it something really easy to bite into. So it could be, okay. So what I would have you do then is to, first of all, notice that you can change the color and the shape of the apple and the plate.
Okay.
Right? And then once you've made it look as, and just notice the choices you're making, you know, like, is it a paper plate? Is it a porcelain plate? Is it a green apple? Is it a red apple? Is it a tall apple? Is it a short apple? Does it have a leaf on it? And again, as you're doing that, to notice how easy it is for you. And whatever way you're seeing that image, it is there for you and you're able to change it. So then I suggest in your mind's eye, in your imagination, just picking up the plate and noticing with the apple on it and noticing just what it feels like in your hand, like both the weight and the texture, and even the temperature, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. And then I would say you can put the plate down and now pick up the apple in one hand. And first of all, just as a test to see how this works for you, bring it to your nose in your mind's eye. You don't have to actually move your hand. In your mind's eye, bring it to your nose and smell the apple and see if you can get a whiff.
All right.
Okay. And then take a bite. And as you're chewing it, notice all the sensations, you know, the flavor, also the juiciness, the crispiness, the crunchiness, how long it takes to chew, what it feels like in your mouth, what it tastes like, and what it feels like to swallow. And just enjoy that process, right? And that's a great way to improve your overall sort of imagining skills.
Okay. So that's interesting because in so doing, my brain feels like it's in a different place now, having done that visualization across and experiencing the imagery on the senses. And so, well, I guess a couple things. One, this mini course, what's the URL?
So I would go to my site, Jane Ransom. That's all one word. No E on the end, janeransom.com. And then go to the book page. And it's right up there in the corner. I think you have to opt in, but it's free. And it's a really good course and it's really short. I think that's the first exercise is the first part. Module is practicing that. Or no, maybe the first part is setting your intention. And I'll give you that quick as well, but go through the course because it leads you through and it's very, very fast and it's really carefully thought out so as to not waste people's time. But the other part that I would do before doing the actual hypnosis, and you're right, even the visualization part that you just did gets you a little trancey. But the other part I would do is practice setting your intention. Like suppose you want to feel more, you said confident, right?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so can you think of a time when you felt the kind of confidence that you would like to feel more of?
Okay, sure.
Okay, do you want to share it?
Well, yeah, I guess I'm thinking about, I guess this is maybe kind of like a winning victory moment associated with confidence. I remember when I was in college, there was a time in which I was facilitating for the Model United Nations Club.
Wow.
A date auction fundraiser. And so I was kind of like the MC guy. So I felt totally confident doing that because I had done it before. And, you know, these were mostly all my friends. But at the same time, I felt so confident that when I got a phone call about a job that I was very much wanted to have.
Yeah.
I just passed the mic over to someone else, like, okay, now you tackle this. It just walked off like, it's fine. I could just do that. I could be on front of the stage speaking facilitated confidently, and then I could just walk off at a moment's notice because I've got something to do. And so yeah, that felt pretty darn confident, because I think many people would be like, oh, I can't just leave the stage. You know, everybody's looking at me. It's like, no, I'm running the show and I'm just going to walk now.
I love that. And I love how your own confidence also, it's spread out to include really confidence in the people around you as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're great. They're totally trustworthy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you got this, fine. Here's the bike.
You know, but that is, I think, a sign of genuine confidence also, when we're able to trust others. So that's beautiful. And that's how you as a leader, as a confident leader, are then, you know, that's part of the leadership too, right? Is trusting others, not feeling, because some people, they think it's about being in control, being confident, but I just love that. Okay. So you know that, you remember that time, and you remember you're right there. So can you conjure up that situation in your mind? Can you remember, like, maybe even what you were wearing and what the place looked like around you? Who was there?
Oh, sure. Well, it was the University of Illinois Alumni Union, one of the ballrooms. There were many folks I knew from the club who were there, and then their friends of friends that they had roped in to do some bidding. And so they were there. I was wearing a suit. Probably my only suit at the time at college, my one suit. And yeah, it was black, and don't recall the shirt combo, but yeah, that's that.
Okay. And do you remember what it felt like to be wearing that, your one suit, the black suit?
Well, I mean,
And you could pause a moment, kind of go inward here, like,
oh, sure.
You know, to actually kind of feel it on your body. Like, what did it feel like on your shoulders? The weight of it, the texture, the warmth or coolness of it, the, you know, the give of it or the constriction of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the time it fit well. I guess it's funny, I was wearing it earlier in the day for interviews. So it's funny, it might have been kind of wrinkly or kind of a little bit dusty or dirty, but I didn't seem to care at all.
I love it. Even better. Yeah. Even better. That's great. Okay. So then what I would advise you to do, and you don't have to go through this whole thing now, but is to spend some time revisiting that moment, and then to invite into your whole being, body and mind, because remember, those are the brain-body loop. It's all really one entity. To bring into your, you know, brain-body loop what that confidence felt like. And, you know, we tend to feel our emotions in the body. So to become aware, you're wearing that one suit, you know, you're in that place where you recognize these people, you recognize the location, you might notice textures and colors and architecture, things like that. So you've got all that surrounding kind of nailed down, and then let yourself go inward and recapture what that confidence felt like. Now you might want to spend more time with this, but can you begin to get a sense of it right now?
Oh yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Okay, good. Okay. So that'll help you even without hypnosis. It's a great way to just practice confidence. Remember, brain plasticity, neuroplasticity is all about just strengthening those pathways. So you've got that pathway already in you. It's a matter of kind of bringing it back, right? And now strengthening it. So what I do with people, like training them to do self-hypnosis, you know, I'm like, pick the thing you want to feel, say confidence. Choose the event that you want to draw from and work on imaging that in your mind with all the sensations, and particularly revisit what it really feels like. Now, if you were to go into hypnosis, either with somebody else hypnotizing you or practicing self-hypnosis, then you bring that word with you and that memory, and you practice them in hypnosis. And what hypnosis seems to do is to, it sort of puts visualization on steroids. It seems to remap the brain more quickly and more powerfully than can be done outside hypnosis. Why that is true, though, I don't know.
Well, that's fascinating. So you mentioned some of the cool research. What I love on your website, you know, that page that has the book, you've also got, talk about being a science nerd, you've got all of the references, and there are many of them.
The bibliography, yeah.
28 pages of them, you know, each pointing to the particular, you know, journal articles or books or whatnot for each chapter. So I feel like I could put you on the spot. So tell me, we heard about some cool results for hypnosis for bones healing faster and better surgical outcomes. Any other cool hypnosis study results to speak to with regard to, I don't know, healing from trauma or sort of a kind of capability development like we were talking through?
Do you ever hear of the late pianist, Glenn Gould?
That sounds familiar.
Okay. He was like one of the great classical pianists. He practiced more in his mind than he did physically. So he visualized practice. And they've done studies, like they did a long ago, a classic study with some dart throwers. They got a bunch of people at the same level of training. They had half of them practice. They had one third of them practice throwing darts every day. Mm-hmm. And then they had one third not practice at all. And then they had the last third practice one day actually throwing the darts. And on the other days, every other day, practice only in their minds. And guess which group improved the most?
The visualizers.
Yeah, because you can have a perfect practice. And also you can prepare for the worst. So Michael Phelps, for example, talked about how he would visualize getting water in his goggles. You know, he would use it to prepare for any situation. And the reason I wanted to mention this is sometimes people use the word visualize and they're like, visualize your success, you know. But studies show that merely fantasizing about something can actually have a detrimental effect. So if you go around like just fantasizing that you're winning an Emmy or something, that is actually probably going to decrease your motivation to actually do something and won't help you at all. But if you do visualization in a disciplined, focused way, it will remap your mind really for much better performance. And then if you pair it with hypnosis, oh my gosh, you can become unstoppable.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Well, tell me, Jane, anything else you want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and talk about some of your favorite things?
Let's see. My problem is I always like to talk about everything. I would like to mention one book that people should read that has nothing to do with hypnosis.
All right.
Okay. And it's been out for a while, but it's sort of like brain plasticity that people often use the term growth mindset, and they don't really know what it means yet, and they're not fully appreciating it or taking advantage of it. And I do not know this scientist personally, but her book changed my life. This is Carol Dweck, mm-hmm. Mindset, the New Psychology of Success. And do you know about this research, Pete, a little bit? Okay. So I'm just going to quickly sum it up for people, because this changed my life. She has found that when we praise somebody for being smart or intelligent, we undermine their authentic confidence. When we praise ourselves for being smart or intelligent, we undermine our authentic confidence. That doesn't mean we should tell people they're stupid. That will even be worse. But what you always want to be, and this has to do with the subconscious mind, because we think of those traits as innate and they feel that they don't have any control over them. So once somebody gets labeled as smart, for example, they become subconsciously afraid to take on challenges that might make them look dumb, right? Because they feel like they don't have much control over that. The thing to praise is effort. Because our brains are plastic, are malleable, we can actually become smarter. And the guy that invented the IQ test, Alfred Binet, never meant it to be a test of what people are throughout their entire lives. He actually invented it. He was French. He invented it because he thought some school kids were being badly educated. And so he thought they could do much better if their education improved. So he took a baseline IQ test with a purpose of proving that with better teaching, their IQs would go up, which indeed did happen.
Mm.
So anyway, everyone should read that book and keep that in mind. So when you praise people, and this is really important for managers as well, never tell people, oh, you're so brilliant. Oh, you're so talented. Praise them for what they actually do, their effort and their strategies.
All right. Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now could you share with us a favorite quote, something you find inspiring?
Yeah. This was hard to choose as well. Can I give you two?
Oh, sure thing.
Okay. One of my clients turned me on to, it's by Teddy Roosevelt, "With self-discipline, most anything is possible."
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, something else we could talk about in a different conversation, but self-discipline and self-forgiveness go hand in hand. So if you want to be more self-disciplined, be more self-forgiving. And then the other quote that I love is Walt Whitman from Song of Myself. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes.
Excellent. And how about a favorite study? We mentioned a few, but are there any others that are mind-blowing for you?
Many. But to stay sort of on topic, I will say that because there are amazing brains with amazing studies into the split brain subjects having to do with what we do with the question why, which is some wonderful, crazy stuff. But I'll just point to Carol Dweck's work because she has, for example, given a bunch of school kids the same test. They all do well. Tells half of them, you did well, you must be really smart. Tells the other half, you did well, you must put a lot of effort into what you do. And then they're put through all the same learning program. And these studies that have been with kids and with adults and professionals prove over and over again that the people who are primed with a fixed mindset and told they're smart start underperforming. And the people primed with the growth mindset, praise for effort, embrace challenge, and they don't mind failure. So it's just a great thing to do.
Beautiful. And how about a favorite book?
Oh, again, so many. But so I've mentioned Carol Dweck. John Rady, Spark, which is about how physical exercise is just about the best thing you can do for your brain. And then another book that changed my life is came out around 2007. I think it was one of the first books on brain plasticity for lay people. That's by Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself.
Oh, thank you. And how about a favorite tool?
Self-hypnosis, for sure.
Okay. And habit?
Yeah. Okay. So I always tell people to make things easy on themselves. Like I was saying, self-discipline and self-forgiveness go hand in hand. Also, just making things easy. So for example, I like to stay fit. I don't watch TV, but I have a screen up that's connected to my computer so I can watch Netflix. My rule is I never watch anything on that screen unless I am also simultaneously exercising. So I have like a stationary bike, I have a hula hoop, I have weights, whatever. It doesn't matter what I'm doing, but I simply do not watch anything at all unless I'm exercising. And it makes exercising so easy.
Oh, lovely. And tell me, is there a particular nugget you share that really seems to connect and resonate with your audiences?
You know, it probably has to do with self-forgiveness and going easy on yourself. People think that change has to be hard. It doesn't. It's oddly enough, the nicer you are to yourself, the easier change will come. And that means practicing self-forgiveness. And it means setting up situations, like I was just saying, like, you know, with my Netflix, to make things easier on yourself. Because self-discipline is like a muscle. You know, the more you use it, the stronger it is. But on the other hand, you don't want to be spending it on, you know, on stuff that doesn't matter or that isn't necessary throughout the day. So when I work with people, the main thing is self-forgiveness. And I'll just say it here, even though we're not going to talk about science on it, but self-love. Love yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say self-forgiveness, since we've hit this a couple times.
Yeah.
In practice, what does that look, sound, feel like? Is it just like, Pete, I forgive you for sleeping in until, you know, those many hours instead of exercising the way you had hoped to? Is that all I do? Or how does one forgive oneself?
In a way, kind of, yes. Do you know what the hell effect is? It's a scientific term.
I don't think I do.
Okay. Okay. The what the hell effect is the fact that if you beat up on yourself, let's say you did sleep in, the more you beat up on yourself, the more you chastise yourself for that, the more likely you are to do it again. And this has been proven over and over with overeating, overdrinking, procrastinating, not studying for exams, whatever it is. The harder a person is on themselves, the more likely they are to repeat the bad habit. And by the harder they are, you can test that by seeing how bad do you feel about yourself, you know? And what they, some diet researchers discovered this a few decades ago, and what they called it the what the hell effect, because what they hypothesize is that the subconscious is basically saying, well, I guess all is lost. What the hell? I might as well keep doing the bad thing. I love that. Kelly McGonigal, who wrote a book called The Willpower Instinct, which I also recommend, calls the what the hell effect the biggest threat This is her quote, the biggest threat to willpower worldwide.
Tweet that. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it is counterintuitive, but the harder you are on yourself, the harder it becomes. So in your example, if you sleep in, yeah, what you do is you say, hey, people, everybody screws up now and then. We are all beautifully imperfect. It is the human condition to be imperfect. Okay, I screwed up today. Oh, well, I'm going to do, you know, better going forward, and that's great, but I certainly forgive myself. And I know, as silly as that sounds, it, trust me, this is actually proven science, and it's very powerful. I had one client who, won't go into the whole story here, but he was having major problems in his life, and they surfaced when he originally came in. As he was very out of shape, and he had a gym membership, and he wasn't able to, you know, he was like, I haven't gone, and I'm a fat slob, and this and that. And he was having issues in a number of other areas in his life. And we worked on the self-forgiveness, and his whole life turned around. And what turned out for him is that he'd actually been carrying a lot of guilt because he was a Vietnam vet, and he'd, you know, actually had killed people and never dealt with it. And we didn't have to go over the details. He didn't need to talk it out. You know, I don't do talk therapy in that regard. But what we did is some self-forgiveness exercises, and you can use visualization too. You know, sometimes I will ask people to just close their eyes and imagine wrapping a nice self-forgiveness blanket around themselves. And I'll have clients hug themselves. I'll have them go into hypnosis and, you know, picture holding themselves as a baby, anything to kind of loosen up our adult self-criticism, which can be so harsh. Because, you know, we are, think about a child learning to walk. And I know many people use this metaphor, but it's really, or this analogy, but it's really true. When a little kid is learning to walk, they are falling down a lot. And we don't sit there and go, oh, you idiot. You know? We're like, yay, rock on, get up and try again. And we really, we need to be that loving toward ourselves. And the science says that is what will really help you to walk faster.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. And if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
I'd point them to my website, janeransom.com. And again, they can find that self-hypnosis course on the book page.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a final challenge or call to action you'd issue to folks seeking to be awesome at their jobs?
Yeah, I would say make an effort to praise somebody, and it could be yourself today, if it's not the very end of the day for you, specifically for something that they did, but make a practice of praising people for effort. And it takes effort to praise people for effort, because you can't just say, great job. You know, you have to actually say, oh, you did a really nice job of keeping everybody engaged and bringing out the people who weren't speaking, or whatever it is. But so my call to action is make an effort to praise effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jane, this has been a whole lot of fun. Thank you for taking this time. And I wish you lots of luck with the book, Self-Intelligence, and all you're up to.
Thank you, Pete. I've had fun. Thank you.
I got a real kick out of Jane sharing some of that hard-hitting scientific evidence associated with bones healing faster, quicker recovery, less anesthetic required in order to have a surgery when it comes to hypnosis, which is pretty handy when you hear about something that may be considered, I don't know, out there or woo-woo or different or untested. Jane brings some of that to bear. So that's kind of exciting for me. There's a whole new pathway that's worth a bit of exploration now that there is a basis for it beyond what happened when I was a freshman at the University of Illinois and I was called up on stage for a stage hypnotist. That was a very different experience. I recall we all gave birth and someone said that they needed to clean their baby with Tylex. It was in the hypnotized trance type state. It was kind of pretty silly. We all had a big laugh and a good little way to get acquainted with people on the campus and all it has to offer, but not at all a serious tool for behavioral change. And Jane unpacked that in a cool way. So appreciate that, Jane. Hope you dug it too. You might explore her course and some of the resources over at her site. Again, the links to access that stuff all the more quickly is awesomeatyourjob.com/ep380. And if you haven't already, I hope you'll push subscribe. You'll hear from our next guest. It is Sulaima Gourani, and we are talking about dignity and achieving stuff, how it's done. Hope to catch you there. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. To get the most out of this conversation, visit awesomeatyourjob.com to find today's show notes, transcript, and infographic summary cheat sheet. For more entertaining professional skill sharpening, be sure to subscribe to catch the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.